Hey folks, welcome to River Talk Podcast. We are talking with Mark Hurst in a follow-up to questions about the International Rafting Federation standards and training. Zach will get into it a little bit. I don't think we have much news of the week this week, but this weekend is scheduled to be the Wind River Race, which is in Carson, Washington.
It's not this weekend, though. It's March 14th.
Oh, next weekend.
It's 2 weeks.
Correction.
It's like, yeah, it's like 11 days from now.
Okay. Yes, you are right. I am wrong. It's been a morning and a half.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that the water levels will provide good opportunity to race. Even if it's a little bit low, I'm sure it'll still be a good excuse to get together and paddle some white water and then do a little award ceremony afterwards. So let's all hope for rain.
And we've done the wind festival as low as 4.5, which that's what it is today. So it's definitely bony, but it's certainly doable.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just a, you know, maybe a little less competitive and more on the social side of things if it's a little bit low.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, hopefully
it's always a crapshoot as to what water level you're going to get for that race because it's so early in the season.
What's crazy is I think the first 7 years we did it, it was always really good. And then lately it's been either high or low.
You used up all those good years.
We got super lucky. Maybe Tim Brink was the good luck charm.
It's probably.
Like as soon as Tim went away, the flows did weird things.
Yeah, did you have any other pertinent news of the week?
I got nothing. It's a pretty straightforward week. But yeah. I'll introduce our guest. Our guest we're bringing back on the show, Mark Hurst. Mark has a business where he basically travels the world and teaches guides, Swiftwater Rescue, International Rafting Federation courses. He does all kinds of cool things. And I was lucky enough to take a course with him last spring and wanted to bring him back on the show and talk more about the International Rafting Federation and sort of what he does. So, yeah, welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, guys. It's nice to be back.
Yep. And I know you're in Finland right now. What time is it in Finland?
It is 10 minutes past 10.
Oh, man. Well, thanks for staying up late with us.
It's okay.
So, well, let's just get started. I think if those of you that are river guides, this is pertinent. If you're a private boater, this might be interesting to you. It might not be. But first of all, Mark, do you want to just tell us what the IRF is?
The IRF was formed quite a few years back at the end of the Camel Cup. The Camel Cup was an adventure race that used to move around different areas of the world. And with the end of cigarette advertising and sport, the race finished, and there was still a call from rafting racing teams around the world to have rafting world championships, and the IRF was born out of that. So the IRF is mainly split into two main key areas. You've got the racing side of things that obviously organize the rafting world championships, and then the area that we're involved in, or I'm involved in, is the guide training area, which is responsible for creating a set of tests and awards for commercial river guides all over the world.
And so why do we need I think the rafting racing part's interesting, but I think we want to get into more of the guide certification or the guide awards. Why do we need awards? Why is this important?
I think basically where you're going around the world, when you travel around the world, you know, there's a lot of countries that are asking for, you know, in this day and age now, bits of paper, you know, a qualification. They're asking to prove guide competency for commercial guides. And there's not one governing body award, or there's not one award that's accepted around the world besides the IRF. So the IRF got together and created our award system so that it doesn't matter where a guide works, whether he works in the States, Africa, New Zealand, they've all been through the same test and they've been proved, their skills have been proven competent on the classification of water that they're working on. So therefore, hopefully they can give their commercial customers a safer experience.
Like, who decides that? Like, who, you know, I've been asking a lot of guides through this guide quiz I put out, you know, what standards are, or, I mean, I'm kind of getting at, like, what are best practices? Who sat around and came up with these best practices? Was it like a committee? Was it an individual person? Or, and how are they, how do you know guides are able to guide class three or four?
It was originally set up by a group of experienced raft instructors. I think the first workshop would have been, I think it was way back in 97. When the IRF was formed, and those guys got together in South Africa, and you had representatives from all around the world, and they took the best parts of each of the world, each of the different governing bodies from around the world. So, for instance, there were people there from New Zealand, from South Africa, there were people there from the UK, they got together, Australia, they got together and came up with a set of standards which came onto the tests that we have nowadays. Nowadays, now we have the GTE committee, and they are a group of instructors that are based all around the world. And we get together and we talk about the different standards, and we can change the awards as and when we feel that the industry needs it. The next big meeting is going to be in France in April. Which is going to be the IRF conference. And at that point, we'll look at the awards, we'll look at the current system, and we'll ask questions of, is the system doing a good job at the moment? Do we need to change anything? And then we'll take things on from there.
And so it sounds, this is super interesting. I mean, these are things I generally don't know the answer to these questions, so I'm asking you things I'm wondering about. It seems like the rest of the world sort of uses this IRF standard. Does, in the US we don't, do you think that we could benefit from the US, or are we good? I know that's a tough question and it's kind of loaded.
I'm not trying to be big head or anything, but yeah. The guides, when we did the workshop with you last year, did they learn anything?
Absolutely.
There you go. Yeah, you know, and a lot of people come onto a course and their main goal at the end of it will be to, you know, get that piece of paper or get that standard. But at the end of the day, you know, when I came out to you guys last year, we had 5 or 6 days together of learning, and we had people from pretty much all over the world, and we got together and, you know, we all learned something from everybody. So not only are the workshops aimed towards getting a qualification and a bit of paper, but it's learning from each other and learning best global current practice, which is what the workshops are aimed at, really.
Yeah, and the one thing that blew me away was I just assumed, because we're in the US and we guide all the time, that we're currently using the global current practices, but there were so many things I took away that the rest of the world is doing that I applied to my own personal guiding in the business basically right away. I was like, oh wow, that's cool to know what's happening or what's going on in the rest of the world. So that was fascinating for me. I think one thing that people don't understand about the IRF course, and I didn't understand, I thought I was taking a class almost, but it's more like a workshop to test your skills. Do you want to talk to that, like the intention of the workshop?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard, especially in the States. You have to tread carefully. You have people, when you go to a new country that's not used to an IRF standard, that somebody that's an outsider is going to come in and watch you raft, and they're going to standardize your rafting, and they're going to predominantly pick holes out of what you do. And raft guides are all alpha male type guys, you know, the big strong guys who don't want someone to tell them, you know, where they're going wrong. So we've got to be careful when we go into places. But you get people that say, I've been a professional raft guide for 20 years and they've been doing the same river for 25 years, the same river for 20 years, and they're not seeing what's happening in the rest of the world. And the skills that they've been practicing for 20 years, they might be professional at those skills, but unfortunately the skills that they're practicing might be wrong. So hopefully they're going to see, when they do a workshop, they can give themselves a chance to prove themselves, to say, yes, I'm a good raft guide. But then they can also hopefully be able to learn and look at ways to make themselves even better and realize their strengths and their weaknesses.
If you told me that before the class, I'd be like, no, I'm perfect. I'm an experienced guy. I can do everything. And I know things I learned. But can you give examples of things you see? People like if you see somebody who's worked in one river for 20 years, that they need to learn, or something you've taught, or open their eyes to, like an example of it?
I suppose a classic one for me really is whenever I've worked with American guides and guides from the States, you know, pretty much all over the world, we use this get down command. You know, we tell our customers, you know, if there's a chance that the boat's going to flip, hit a rock, hit a big wave, we get the center of gravity low inside the boat to stop people from spilling out. And also getting people down in the bottom of the boat is going to change the shape of the bottom of the boat, allowing it to punch through bigger waves. And a lot of people have been rafting, you know, 10, 20 years. They're very good guides, but they've never used this get down command. And just by saying, hey, you know, have you tried this? Mm-hmm. Next time you run that rapid, maybe try this and you'll have even more success. You know, you'll keep people in the boat. You won't put people in the water, which is going to put them at risk. And, you know, this might work for you.
Hmm. Any other examples that you can think of?
I think equipment, and you know, I know you love to talk about it, but the clean line principle, and you know, setting up and wearing equipment, which I know is going to be one of the questions you ask me later on. But yeah, definitely, a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about equipment and kit nowadays. Yeah. And someone who's worn a flip line around their waist for 25 years, you know, can't see anything wrong with it. Then you come at one of these classes and we can start to talk about the pros and cons of wearing a flip line around your waist.
Yeah. What I really liked about your take on this stuff was you were like, hey, this is a standard. And tell me if I'm wrong, Bayard. I felt like you came to us and said, hey, this is a standard. You know, do it, you know, like you can choose to change. You might want to. And then you'd provide data and actual examples. Yeah. And you'd show us videos. Like, hey, if you want to keep wearing your flip line, watch this video. This might change your mind. And that was really good for us. It wasn't just like, hey, I know it's right, do this. It was like, here's what the rest of the world is doing, here's why, and here are examples. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. I think you've got to go, and you, I think the moment you come in and as an instructor coming in from overseas and you say, hey, do it like this, and you can't provide any backup or any reasoning, you're kind of going to shoot yourself in the foot. So you've got to be able to give some backup, some reasoning. You've got to give evidence and reasons. And then, you know, we're all grown ups. You've got to let people use their own judgment and take away from that what they can.
Yep. What do you, you know, there's a lot of talk lately, and I've been talking lately about standards and best practices, because I'm trying to like come up with this guide quiz that follows standards or best practices, and I'm getting pushback from people who don't think there should be one way of doing things, and I get that. But what do you think about having standards or best practices, or are those even the right words?
I think best practices are good things, you know, are good reasons, good things to have. You know, we can say that, for instance, what a lot of companies are doing, and I know we mentioned it on your course now, is a lot of companies will give all their customers a red helmet, and all their customers will go down the river in a red helmet. And current best practices is that if you've got someone that's maybe a weak swimmer, has a medical condition, a nervous customer, is that you give them a different color helmet, which allows that person to be identified a lot quicker. And that's not a standard, but it's a best practice. It's being adopted around the world.
Yeah, I like that. That one was super cool. There's a bunch of little things like that that I loved.
It's the little pieces of gold. It's the nuggets. It's the reason you do these courses, you got to find that little piece of gold. You know, you'll be given many things, but you've got to find that those few little pieces of gold that you can take away and put into your own rafting.
Yeah. I really like, Mark, how you're saying best practices versus standards. Mm-hmm. And I think in the States, we often lead towards wanting to have these cut and dry standards to check boxes. And it comes from a lot of the times a perspective of liability and avoiding litigation and lawsuits, which in other countries, it isn't the same setup. But I think one of the things that I talked about Zach's quiz with just boaters in that were engaging with it is that there isn't necessarily always a best answer when you have a problem, but there is things that are most commonly practiced, like you're saying, best practices, and things that are when I was teaching rafting classes, like the keep it simple method, mm-hmm. like that's generally always going to apply when you're in a rescue, is like, don't try to set up a mechanical advantage system when you could just offer a paddle to someone, sort of thing. So I think in the States especially, outfitters and trainers and instructors have trouble doing this, and maybe it would be helpful if they did it less, is like the compliance type culture component, and just like you're saying these are things that work right now, and you know, maybe next year someone's going to find a better method, or research is going to say that this isn't so good anymore. Stuff is always changing, we're always learning, but this is the best practices right now.
Yeah, definitely.
And then teach them to be critical thinkers for the more complicated things that may happen.
Yeah. Something I find from working around the world is, you know, what will work for a guide in the States doesn't work for a guide who doesn't speak English as his first language.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you can apply one thing in one country, it doesn't work in another, so you have to be flexible.
Yeah, on that topic, too, Priscilla, I was talking to an outfitter the other day who was telling me he does things because of liability, and he trains mm-hmm. guides on certain things of liability, and I asked the question, what's the right thing to do? Doing the right thing or doing it because of liability? Because sometimes those conflict. You know, maybe you'll do something based on your insurance or being sued that maybe isn't mm-hmm. the safest possible thing. And so what's our responsibility, to be focused on liability or actually be the safest?
Mm. What's an example of something that wasn't safe but was done for liability, just so I can wrap my head around it?
I can't think of one exactly, but an example might be like having throwing a throwback from a raft, right?
Got it.
Where like you want to get, maybe it's not super safe to do, but you mm-hmm. do it because you want to have swimmers minimize the amount of time in the water. That's a terrible
yeah,
example.
Yeah.
But it's something
yeah.
like that, where you're going to follow a specific protocol just because if you get sued, you can be like, oh, I, you know, we're good. We follow the protocols, but maybe it added some level of danger.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're saying now. I think I have a good example, not related to guiding, but related to like search and rescue in the States, and how many check boxes they have to check and how many people they have to call up the line to get approval and how much time that takes. And so all of that is created for a number of reasons. One of it is liability, and a number of it is, you know, safety. But sometimes it gets to the point where, you know, someone has been out in a dangerous situation for, you know, an entire night, and it could have been resolved a lot quicker if there wasn't so many checkpoints and protocols. And sometimes we impose those checkpoints and protocols and rules of thumb on ourselves in our industry without realizing the unintended consequences of doing that.
The one of those I harp on is with this Oregon State Marine Board currently requires guides to carry first aid cards with them, which is mm-hmm. stupid, right? And I call the board and I'm like, I get that we need to have first aid, that makes sense, but the fact that the guide has to carry it with them, it just means on top of everything else they're doing, they also have to go find the first aid card and put in their pocket. And that time mm-hmm. that they're doing to do this thing, that's just checking a checkbox for you, they could be spending, you know, doing other things that make the trip safer. And so you're just creating yeah. busy work for them, which I feel like makes the trips less safe. And it's a small thing, but it's a pet peeve of mine, because it's silly that we have to put a first aid card in our pocket when we're guiding.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like there should be some sort of system where, I mean, I guess in Idaho, we always had to carry our guide licenses with us yeah. that showed that everything was up to date, but it seems silly. Like that's one of those systems that if there's a registry that can be checked by law enforcement officers, then maybe people don't have to carry so many things with them on the river.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to go back to the IRF a little bit, Mark. Do you think that the IRF standards are more of a multi-day thing than more of a single day thing, or a multi-day thing, or just it's across the board?
Across the board. It's across the board. I must admit that when we do IRF workshops tend to attract, in certain countries, more of your day tripper guides. But, you know, the principles of running the river, whether you're running a single day trip or a multi-day trip, are still the same. You know, you're still more or less working off the same set of principles. You know, don't keep eye contact with the boat in front and the boat behind. Make sure everyone's got their PFDs on. Make sure everyone's had a safety demonstration. You know, you white water swim, that's all the same. When I've worked on workshops where we've done workshops on multi-day trips, you have to be flexible, and there's certain things that you have to think about more when you're working on a remote multi-day trip than you do, for instance, on a road supported day trip when there's a car right next to you when you get out. But I think it's definitely the IRF will cater for both.
Yeah, I mean, I think like clean land principle is something that I've been talking about more since I met you and talking about it, and I get it. I think on multi-day trips, it's really hard to do realistically. And
yeah,
because you have to strap down bags have backpack loops. So I think, I think it's like with clean land principle, you want to do your very best, but 100% compliance is going to be tough.
No, absolutely. I mean, even in a day trip, you know, when you talk about that, you're strapping down bags on a day trip, you know, it's quite funny now, because I call them the clean line police. You know, you get people that go way too far. For instance, I was in the UK, and a guy, without actually asking me, came up to me, and the zip on my dry suit that's got the loop on your dry suit zip that you pull, he come up, he said, "That's a trap. That's an entrapment hazard," and he cut straight through it. And I just looked at him, and I was like, I didn't want to be angry at the guy, but I was like, actually, no, you've got a good point there. That is an entrapment hazard. And you get the people that take it a bit too far. But yeah.
And the last IRF question I want to go into before we get into like best practices a little bit, is just about like IRF in the United States. Do you think that we would benefit from it, or what would be the benefits of more guides took IRF workshops?
Well, Zach, I'll be honest with you, mate. Since we did that workshop last year in your place, we've got, I don't know if they've come directly from you, but there's going to be double the amount of IRF courses in states this year than there was last year. Last year was already a record year. So the interest is there. Something else that we've just noticed as well is that we don't know where it's come from, because they've not spoken to the IRF, but Airbnb have started to ask that any Airbnb hosts that offer rafting have to have IRF qualified guides of running their trips.
Yeah, I've had a few people contact me just because of that. Like, they wanted Airbnb experiences. But one of them, it turns out they have to have a captain's license too, which is just kind of ridiculous.
Okay.
But hopefully the captain's license thing goes away. But that's definitely a factor. But I mean, which that's all great. I just want to, like, the average guide in the, let's say somebody's been guiding for 15 years. They've worked a bunch of different places. What do you think the benefit is for somebody like that to take an IRF workshop? Or is there any?
For me, if I'd been a guide for 15 years and I had an opportunity to go on a workshop, learn a heap of new stuff, meet some new people, and reinforce to myself how good my guiding skills are by taking this test, I'd jump on it. I'd buy it. I'd sign up for that class.
Well, let's move on to best practices really quick. And these are just discussions I've been having like crazy since I put that quiz thing out. And I just want to get your thoughts, Mark, because you definitely like see so many different things, and you've seen so many different countries and types of guiding, and get your input, which I really appreciate. And Priscilla, I love your inputs too. So please jump in, Priscilla.
Will do.
First of all, like the throwing throw bags from rafts. Is it okay? If not, are there exceptions?
After you, Priscilla.
Well, for me, it's entirely situational. If you're in a big water river where there's no rock, tree hazards, and you need to get somebody out of the water as quick as possible to eliminate exposure and like aspiration of water, I would do whatever I needed to get them back into the boat, and just think about, you know, critically, how am I throwing the rope? Like, trying not to position the raft so that it's not over the top of or tangling the other guests in a throw bag, that sort of thing. I've certainly done it before in a large river where, you know, a little kid fell out and I wanted to get them back in the boat as soon as possible. And I didn't think anything about it. I can see where it would quickly become dangerous if you're just, again, following rules of never and always, if that makes sense. So if you're always saying, get the person back in the boat as soon as possible, you might make an error and not see the obvious hazard of, you know, a rock or a tree, or maybe you have another boat nearby that it gets tangled up in, or anything like that. But if you're saying never do it, then you may unintentionally cause someone excess harm by not doing something that could have most quickly resulted in their getting back in the boat or their rescue. So, yeah, those are my quick and summary thoughts on that.
I would say never say never. Something I've seen on my travels. I've been to one European country where they are taught from day one, if they have a swimmer, the guide bags them from the boat. And this leads to all types of carnage. I also, something I see a lot of, and I saw a complaint. I saw this on a workshop, and I saw a commercial trip having this issue. And this is no lie. I watched a guide do a safety demonstration, and he explained to his customers, if you fall out of the boat, we will throw a rope to you. And he stood in the raft as part of his pre-departure safety talk, safety demonstration, and he demonstrated throwing a rope from a raft to a make-believe swimmer, and, you know, they spoke about how to receive the line. That same trip went down the river, and the customer fell out of the raft and was swimming in the water and was screaming, rope, rope, rope. And that this was a customer who was, you know, he was expecting the throw line to be thrown from the raft to him because that's what had been given to him in the demonstration. The guide eventually got him back in the raft without throwing the rope. And the consequence of that was, the guide said, well, no, we don't throw ropes from a raft. But in the safety demonstration, the guide had demonstrated throwing a throw bag from the raft. And how many times have you seen a guide do a safety talk, and when they talk about throwing a rope, the guide stands in the raft and throws the rope to the make-believe swimmer on the land. And that's something that happens all over the world.
So, I mean, do you think it's just okay practice to do, Mark? Or is it something you should be very conscious about?
I would go with probably teaching the bring it all into the safety demonstration, you know, briefing the customers. If you fall out of the raft, try your best to swim to the raft. And then also, if there is a swimmer, we're telling our crew to start paddling so we can get to the swimmer. But I would never say 100% no, don't throw the rope from the raft. I would say there's always going to be that 5% of you may have to use it sometime.
And let's say it's just out of convenience. Like somebody's 20 feet away, you're like, oh, I'll just throw them a bag. It'll save them from swimming. Would you do it then? And I honestly, this is not loaded. I'm generally curious what you guys think. Like they're going to be fine. It just like it's easier to throw a bag 20 feet and pull them in and makes their short swim a little bit better. Or would you go with them?
I think for me with the when I think from years of rafting, it's just automatically ingrained to me. If I've got a swimmer that's 20 feet away from the raft, hopefully they've had a good safety demonstration. As soon as they're 20 feet away from the raft, they know from the safety demonstration that it's time to swim back to the raft. And for me as the guide, it's time for me to, you know, go into that area where I know I've got to go and paddle to pick the swimmer up. So for me to contemplate using a throw bag from a raft, it doesn't necessarily come straight away.
I'm pretty hardcore against throwing him because I know of some fatalities. And so I feel those people would be alive if they hadn't thrown a throw bag. And that kind of is crazy to me. So I'm like maybe on the board against it.
if you look at it as well, as you've got most guides, when they throw a throwback, they miss. And that's when they're stood static on the land to a swimmer moving down the river. If you put that guy, that customer in a, you've got a customer swimming down a rapid and you've got a guide in a raft that's moving, that's two moving objects. You know, your accuracy is being slashed by a huge percentage.
Well, let's move on to the next controversial one, and that's how long the safety talk should be. I think I annoyed a lot of people by suggesting that it's 10 minutes. What do you guys think about safety talks? What's a good length for a safety talk?
Priscilla?
Back at me. Well, I think if you can say the most important things and make it appealing to multiple types of learning, so hands-on with like a volunteer, visual, auditory, and make it, you know, about 3 minutes, I think that you will not lose people's attention spans. In my experience, depending on, you know, the type of trip and the age range of the group, if you have a mixed group and kids, most of them are excited about bouncing around on the raft and messing with gear. Adults are trying to manage whatever's going on with themselves and their friends and kids. So it's really hard to keep people's attention, especially if you're doing, depending on the setting of the safety talk. If it's inside a building, it's a little easier. If it's outside near the river, which is where I always used to do mine, then there's a lot of distractions. So I think if you can have the major takeaways outlined and demonstrated in a quick and brief way, and then at the end have a little mini test for, you know, random members of the group just to recall their memory and ensure that they understood the important components, and then a wrap up, and then doing little reminders down the river as you're doing some of your other teaching of the clients. I think that's really the best way to do it. I've learned that overwhelming people with lots of information and too many details, and then not just kind of highlighting the quick level summary and testing them on that knowledge results in them not retaining anything. So,
Priscilla, yeah. Are you saying 3 minutes?
Yeah, I think 3 minutes is a good amount of time to do the, like, just overview safety talk. And then what I would do after that, and again, it's different if it's a multi-day trip or a more difficult river, my safety talk is a bit longer and more detailed. But say just like a normal day trip, class 3-4 on the Rogue or something, then I'd be kind of 3-ish minutes, maybe 5 for the overall like raft safety, general rules of the river. And then after that, I would do a demonstration on throw bags and grab a member of the audience to help demonstrate, or one of the other guides in the group. And then I would do a quick demonstration on how to paddle, how to use paddles as a rescue tool and not as a face breaking tool. And, and then we would wrap up with ensuring that everyone's PFDs and helmets, if that was a trip with helmets, were fitted appropriately and put them in the raft. And then once we got on the river, we would do, you know, again, this was on the Rogue and usually summertime trips, so people want to get in the water. We'd practice pulling each other into the raft, do a couple little rescue drills while we're going down the river. But I would kind of consider that outside of the safety talk and more just encouraging learning and safety alongside all the other things that you're doing on the trip for them.
So you're saying you do like a core short thing that has the basics, yeah, like keep your feet up, you know, mm-hmm, what to do if you fall out. And then you kind of like peter more information out over the next hour.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've just figured out that tactile learning it leads to people retaining the information better, especially when it's an activity that is physical and engaging with multiple people in the group anyway.
Tactile learning? What does it mean?
So like hands-on. Okay, so like, so like someone can tell you how to like peel an orange, like lecture you on how to do it, but you're not really going to know how to do it until you peel an orange, yeah, like with your hands. And so I find that a lot of people, if they are very new to the sport, which a lot of, you know, commercial rafting guests are, they do it maybe once a year, maybe that's the only time they do it. talking to them about these things is often lost when it comes to the like pulling people into a raft, using your paddle a certain way, that sort of thing. So if you take it to the river, you're no longer making them antsy and like, oh my gosh, when am I going to get on the river? And you're having them on the river doing the trip and also encouraging learning and asking questions when you can in the flat water and that sort of thing.
To follow up with what you said, is having a quiz at the end. I find the most effective part of my safety talk is a quiz at the end where I'm like, hey, I'm going to ask three questions. And it's typically like, what's the most dangerous part of the river? Which I explain to them as the interaction between the shore and the river. And then, or I say where the most injuries happen, that is in between the shore and the shore and the raft. And then I say, what do you do when you fall out immediately, and make sure they know that you can keep your feet up. So I do a quiz with a few things at the end. I think that's the best learning happens with that quiz at the end.
Yeah. I think it's really important to wrap up kind of like how I see it is, or how I've framed it is like an elevator pitch. So if you're doing an elevator pitch, you have your quick pitch in the beginning, and then you kind of have like questions and the fluffy stuff in the middle. And then at the end, you bring it all the way back to your key points at the beginning and make sure that people understand what you're trying to convey.
Mark?
Mm-hmm. I don't call them safety talks anymore. Because when it's a talk, people don't listen. So for me, it's a safety demonstration, and you're looking to cover the three main learning styles: the VAC, the visual, audio, and the kinesthetic. So your talk needs to appeal to your visual learners, to your audio learners, and then getting people to get their hands on to your kinesthetic learners. The people are going to learn by getting hands on. For me, I'm a great believer in the silent safety demonstration. So as little words as possible and more actions. But definitely,
when we took the class, you had me do one of those.
Yes,
it was hard.
So people are, actions speak louder than words. But I'm a big fan of definitely doing the quiz at the end, and then the bite-sized reminders at the top of Big Rapids. So, hey guys, if you fall out of the raft, remember, smile, swim back to the raft, keep your feet up, don't stand up. The raft flips, smile, hold your paddle, stay with the raft. Definitely giving them bite-sized reminders on the way down a river. And if it is going to be that big bouncy class 4 trip where you're going to get swimmers, yeah, definitely let's look at doing a flip on a flat pool before we get into the big stuff. Let's look at pulling each other in, doing rescues, definitely.
One of my favorite parts of your talk, sorry to interrupt, was you really focus on smiling, and you give some factor like it's proven that you can't panic and smile at the same time.
Yep. It's So definitely, you're almost creating a mantra for your guests. Is that if you fall out the raft, smile, hold your paddle, swim back to the raft. If you can't get back to the raft, smile, hold your paddle on your back with your feet up. If the raft flips, smile, hold your paddle, stay with the raft. And you're saying that before you drop into every big rapid, and your guests will go, they will take that swim, that big nasty swim, they'll come running back to you and they'll say, look, I've got my paddle, I'm smiling. And and you're just creating a mantra. But so by the time you go down the river, they've heard that same section of information 4 or 5 times, and you're just ingraining it into them.
And holding onto the paddle is an interesting one we talked about too, because in the U.S. we don't kind of care. Like, I'd rather have somebody swim better than hold the paddle. But what you were saying is, if you're in like the middle of nowhere, Siberia, there aren't paddles. If you lose them, you lose them. So it's really important that the guests hold on the paddles simply because they can't get more.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, in places like Iceland, where they cost a fortune to import paddles to, as an operator, you want your customers to hold on to the paddle.
Let's move on. Another thing the IRF, I noticed in some of the things we do, a big part of the course is being able to do a Z rig or a 3-to-1 or a mechanical advantage system in 5 minutes. Like, you're tested to put together a 3-to-1 in 5 minutes, which is challenging, actually. And it seemed to me like there's a huge focus on setting up 3-to-1s. And I feel like a lot of us are taught to like do that as like the last measure, for a wrap. For a wrap, though, and I think that there's other uses for 3-to-1s. And so why is there such a focus on Z rigs?
I wouldn't say there's a focus on the 3-to-1. There's definitely, as an IRF instructor, we're pushing the strong arm pull, so move your crew around, try and pull the boat off the rock into the rope pull, vector pull, then look at a mechanical advantage system. You can also, you know, deflate some of your tubes, have a play around. We're definitely, you know, we're definitely saying take that approach first. And there are places where you go to around the world. You know, I did a workshop in Bosnia last September, and we did the throwback test on the first day, and all these guys were guiding the raft really well, and we did the throwback test, and they were all absolutely shocking. And I said to them, I said, have you ever used a throwback before? And they said, no. You know, these are guys that have been guiding for 5-6 years. I said, why do you not have a throwback? And they said, we don't have them in our rafting camp, so we don't use throwbacks. So not only did they not get through that throwback test, there's absolutely no way they were going to get through that rope work test. I remember last year on your course, we spent that afternoon on the rope work, and there was generally in the group, there was a lot of questions and there was a lot of enthusiasm around learning more rope work. The IRF test says that they've got to do an internal 3-to-1 or an external 4-to-1 mechanical advantage system as part of the assessment in order to pass.
That was one of the best parts of the course. There were so many great parts of the course, but I think we all knew how to set up a 3-to-1. But when we had to learn tricks to do it faster, we learned a lot of cool techniques.
In the dark and in the rain.
Yeah, it was. That's right. And we learned a lot of tricks that apply to other swiftwater techniques. It wasn't just like canvas up a 3-to-1, which was the test. We learned just a lot of like cool things that we could use for other things.
Mm-hmm.
But are there, when IRF has us practice on 3-to-1, when it's a part of the course, is the main point of a 3-to-1 to pull boats off rocks? Or is it seen as a more useful tool for other types of things?
It's definitely for pulling boats off rocks. Okay. You know, we're not when we're doing when we go through the whole whole IRS assessing system. You know, it's applicable to rafting. Whereas, for instance, if you go and do a Rescue 3 class, we can use mechanical advantage if you're doing advanced classes to raise a load up. You know, getting someone out of a vertical environment, or you can put mechanical advantage on a rope to create a tension diagonal. You know, we don't teach that anywhere on the IRF system. It's all to do with getting bolts that are stuck off.
Cool. Well, let's move on to the next one, and it's the location of the safety kit in the first aid, in my quiz, the most common answer is the last boat, and that's what's been drilled into me most of my career. I know you have a different answer, and I love this discussion. What do you think about that, Priscilla? Or do I don't know if you want to go first again, Priscilla.
Could you repeat the last part of the question?
So I cut out. Where the safety kit goes, where the first aid kit and safety kit goes on a group of rafts.
Oh, I think it depends on what type of raft you are. Are you a 6-pack? Paddle boat? Are you an oared assist? Are you a stern assist? Are you a gearboater with people? I think generally for me, I try to keep the safety kit accessible and not buried. So if I'm in purely a paddle boat, I'll try to do just a one strap or clip of the safety kit, which is like a watershed, a koi bag size thing, so that it's slightly elevated off of the ground, but not in the way of the customers. That way it doesn't get lost underneath other stuff when it's needed. And then it's also not going to pop out of the boat if you flip. So, you know, standard rig to flip.
So maybe not the location in the boat, but in the group of boats. Would you put it in the first
boat? Oh, in the group of boats. Boat? Got it.
Would you put it with a troop leader? Would you put it with the most experienced first aid person? Like, where do you, and so in the quiz, the most common answer to the quiz was last boat. That's what most people answered. And that's what's been drilled into my head my entire career. Is it always last boat, or is there some variability here?
So if you're talking about like the pin kit, and the first aid kit, which we always had separate, depending on the size of the group, we might have multiple first aid kits. And there would be, see, when I worked for OSU, we did a first aid kit in the first boat and the last boat. So like if the first boat, you know, had some sort of medical thing happen or was going to get lunch a little early, they would have that with them. And then the last boat, there is balance. But for the pin kit, it always made the most sense to have the last boat have it, because thinking about if you have only the first boat having it and then they are downstream and the last boat gets pinned, all of a sudden you're having to figure out a way to make your way all the way back upriver with guests in your boat or leaving them behind to get that last boat. So I think the first aid, depending on the group size, but having one in the front of the group makes sense. And then with the pin kit makes the most sense to have it in the back just because of the flow of river. And you might be kicking yourself in the foot if you have to walk upstream to go get your buddy.
That's how I've always been. Mark, I'm curious your thoughts on this.
I personally, we're teaching the 4-3-2-1. So each guide, if they're equipped properly, has got the basics of a pin kit on them, on themselves personally. I worked out in New Zealand, and in New Zealand we were generally doing their 20 boat trips, and within that you would have 3 or 4 first aid kits, 2 or 3 pin kits. I definitely like the idea of having a first aid kit at the front, first aid kit at the back, pin kit at the front, pin kit at the back. I think it's Austria. No, France, sorry. First aid kit in every boat. Love that. And then maybe if I'm multi-daying, a small first aid kit in every boat, and then the trip leader with a bigger first aid, more comprehensive first aid kit. The trip leader for me tends to be the person that the customers, that's their go-to guy on a day trip. So I personally like a trip leader to have a first aid kit, because that's normally the customers will strike that bond with the trip leader. First.
Even if the trip leader is not the most experienced medically, that's an interesting point, because that's who they're probably going to ask.
Yeah, for me, generally, a lot of the places I work, your trip leader might not be the most medically experienced, but if they're trip leading, their medical and their first aid skills should be at a standard where they can deal with most of the things
that makes sense.
On the trip. But yeah, for me personally nowadays, first aid kit, small first aid kit in my boat, pin kit in my boat. You saw the green cross tube bags that I use. Yep, I've got room for a pelly case and a pin kit in there.
Those green bags, I showed people them here in the US, and you can't get them here. So people were stoked on them, but they're not for sale. they're hard for people to use. But for those of you listening, it's basically a thwart bag that's just really durable, really well thought out. That can be It's very versatile too. I loved it. I bought one from Mark when he was over here because I thought it was super cool. And going back to first aid, I think a lot of people who took the quiz wrote this should absolutely go with the person with the most first aid experience, or the highest first aid qualified. And Mark, I agree with you. Like everybody should be at a certain good, especially a trip leader, should be at a certain high level that they can deal with most things. It doesn't have to be with the absolute most experienced person. And it's also hard to judge people. We don't like line people up and say, you know, here's most experienced to least experienced, or most educated to least educated. It's hard to know who that person is, but anybody's a trip leader should certainly be able to handle pretty much anything. So I like that answer a lot.
How many times have you been on a trip and you said, have we got any medical qualified people here? And you've got someone that holds their hands up and says, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse. And then something happens, and then you find out that said doctor or nurse is absolutely useless once they're outside of their doctor's surgery or their ER ward.
It happens to us a lot. You know, usually it's like an infection. Somebody has an infection or something in a multi-day, and we just know that they're like not feeling good. And the doctor, you know, is typically like, yeah, I mean, it could be one of these 8 things, but I don't know what it is. You know, but the doctor actually gives us some confidence usually. For us, I really have them take over and do anything dumb, but they definitely, they're like, yeah, that's bad. You should get them out of here. So they give us confidence for our decision to evacuate them. But for me, it's almost always. We had one trip where a guy took a fish hook to it, like almost his eye, but hit, like cut his face up. And we just happened to have an oral surgeon there that like sewed him up beautifully. So
beautiful.
It turned, and another time I had an oral surgeon around when a guy lost a filling, and the oral surgeon was able to put the filling back in.
Cool.
Anyway, let's move on to cowtails, which Mark, you and I have had a little discussion about this recently. I don't understand why rafters need cowtails.
All right. This is my question. So you guys called that whole cow's tail system a toe tether, don't you? Would I be right for saying that? Yeah. All right. So
I know Priscilla uses them kayaking a lot.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think I used to call it a cowtail, and now I call it a tether and some, I don't know. Yeah.
All right. So the harness. So let's not forget about, let's not use the cowtail. The harness was first designed, I think, by the Germans back in the 70s, 80s, as a way of attaching a person to the end of a rope, a.k.a. to go and do a live bait rescue, or to attach a rope to someone that's potentially pinned and pull them off. The cow's tail came along as an extension, a way of simply clipping the person that has the cow tail attached to them to clip the rope to, so they don't have to be fiddling around on the back of their PFD to find that ring. What's happened over time is that people have gone, oh, wait a minute, if I have to tow a swamped kayak, I can attach my cow's tail to that. And then the use is because not too many people back in the day had done too many safety courses. A lot of people had been educated, oh, it's for towing a swamp kayak with, which is not what it's for. To the point where manufacturers...
I assume that's what they were invented for. I assume they were invented purely to pull kayaks to shore.
No. And then the manufacturers don't help this, because then the manufacturers start to create these elasticated cow's tails that are way too long, that are a massive entrapment hazard. And then people are towing kayaks and getting themselves into all trouble. There was a girl in the Russian kayak slalom championships who took a swim, and she was borrowing her friend's paddle. And she didn't want to lose her paddle, so as she's taking the swim, she took a cow's tail off, clipped it onto the paddle shaft and started to swim. The paddle then got pinned between two rocks, and then she became pinned, and she didn't have the knowledge on how to release her harness, and she got herself into all types of trouble. So the manufacturers, there's a lot of people that are manufacturing the kit that don't actually know what this is used for. I know there's a very popular PFD manufacturer in the States who call it a toe tether, and that's not what it is, and it's not what it's been designed to be used for, but they've put that there. And then you've got a whole generation of boaters that have come through that think it's a toe tether when it's not. It's just a simple way of attaching a set of brains onto the end of a rope. Have I used mine for towing a swamp kayak? Will I still use it? Yes, but I understand the risks, and I know that's not what it's designed for. I don't know if you guys get to see Palm equipment that much, but Palm have just totally redesigned the chest harness. When I come out to the States, when I come to see you guys in April, I'll bring one of the new PFDs with me with the new harness system on it, which is a really good system. So I'll show that to you guys. But yeah, a lot of people call it a toe tether, and it's not a toe tether. Pretty much the UK is really tight on this. You go and tow something off your cow's tail in the UK, you know, you get frowned upon.
So do you call it a cowtail?
I call it a cow's tail, yeah.
Okay. That's what I call it too, but I wasn't sure if there's a technical term. It's not a very technical term, cowtail. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is it's useful to attach yourself to a safety line quicker.
Yeah.
You can still attach yourself to a safety line if you have a harness. You're just saying
you can.
You just need a buddy to do it almost. You're saying that this allows an individual to unclip it, tie it to a safety line, so then they can jump in after a swimmer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then in the 90s, we had this whole thing that people were like, oh, wait a minute, people are clipping themselves into a line quicker and making mistakes. So people came away from using them and said, hey, you know, don't use that cow's tail because it gets in your way. It's an entrapment hazard. Mm-hmm. Why don't you, if you have to clip yourself in, give your rope to a friend who can clip you into your harness and they can double check and you've got two sets of brains either end of the rope then, because people, a lot of people would come from a climbing background and you'd see them setting up all type of interesting anchor systems on the side of the river, attaching the throw bag to one end, attaching themselves to the other end of the rope and throwing themselves in without anybody holding onto the rope at all.
That's how I feel. I feel like if I'm, it's pretty, I've never done this for real life. I've never actually been tied to a rope, jumped in after a swimmer. So I have no experience with this. I understand the concept and I've trained on it, but I figure I have the extra 10 seconds to just have somebody clip into the back of my ring in the back.
Yeah.
Need the thing to attach to.
Yeah. And for me personally, you know, when I was with you guys in April, I put the video on of the unconscious swimmer. Did I show you that one? Being rescued? A cow's tail is a good way of recovering an unconscious swimmer from a kayak. And we've got video evidence of that being used. So, yeah, predominantly, no, it's not a tow tether for towing kayaks, Ruth. But we can use it as long as we understand, you know, the limitations of what we're doing.
I took a safety kayak class in the 90s, and that's what we were taught to. I mean, I use a tow tether in my kayak specifically for an unconscious swimmer. So when I'm safety kayaking, I always have a cow tail with me for that use, mm-hmm. because there's no other way to get an unconscious swimmer to shore without tying onto them somehow. You can't push them ashore with a kayak. But for raft guides, that's what I'm getting at. Do raft guides really need this cow tail?
They're not going to use it as much as a kayaker. But then again, if you get into a swift water rescue type situation where it might come in handy, it shouldn't be a static yes or no. It should be personal choice, an educated personal choice.
And it needs to be tight, right? I feel like a cowtail is a potential, like, violation of clean land principle. Like, you could, if you swim, you could get caught on it. People have and died. So
the problem people have is that, because again, there's a lack of training out there, that they clip it onto, it should be clipped onto something that's releasable if it does get snagged.
Right.
So you see a lot of people clipping it to the material of their vest, which that's not releasable. And yes, that can and has caused deaths. Whereas again, if you look at a well-designed PFD, maybe something like a palm PFD, they've got the little plastic D-ring on them, mm-hmm. and that's got a purposely designed break in the plastic that if it does get snagged, it'll just fall off. A lot of people think, oh, this D-ring's broken. It's actually not. It's supposed to be like that. So if you get a PFD that's got, you know, a good design, for instance, on the front of the green vest, you've got the little press stud. On the front of the green vest, yeah. Clip it onto there.
Cool. And the last question I have is the "Are you okay" symbol, because this is, in the U.S., we all tap our heads, and then that's asking a question to somebody, "Are you okay?" And the answer is tap your head, and they're like, "I'm okay." And I have a hard time doing anything but that, because we all do it all the time. But the IRF symbol, is there an IRF symbol to ask the question, "Are you okay?"
There is an IRF signal for OK, which is the fingers on the top of the head pointing vertically down, which is an international signal.
And is that, I mean, is that asking, like, if somebody's, like, swimming in the river and you're worried about them, and is that asking them that question?
No, it would be, if you were doing, "Are you OK?" you would point at the person, so you make eye contact, point at the person, and you would point at them, "You," and then the hand on the top of the head, "OK."
OK, so, like, if you see a swimmer, you point at that person. If they see you and they're not okay, they just flounder more. If they are okay, they put their fingers down on their head, pointed down at their head.
Yeah.
Is this something you would, like, you would train in a safety talk? Is this something you'd want guests to know, or is this more of a guide thing?
What is a guest going to understand? Are you okay? Give me a thumbs up, or put your hand on the top of your head.
Thumbs up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it goes on to that. You know, I told you when I was there in April about that whole thing in New Zealand where the guide had flipped, recovered his crew. The trip leader looked at the guide and said, "Are you okay?" And the guide, he gave the okay signal back, got down to the bottom and said, "Hey, where's my missing trainee?" And unfortunately, the trainee had drowned. and it went to court. It got nasty, and you know, they asked they said, "I asked you if you were okay," and the guy said, "Yes, you asked me if I was personally okay. You didn't ask me about the crew or the people in my boat."
Wow.
And as a result of that, the New Zealand authorities they changed the okay signal. There's a signal for, "Are you personally okay? Are your crew okay?" And I think when you're working as a group of guides, as a professional group of guides, that's a discussion that needs to take place before you get on the river. What are the signals we're using today, and what do they mean?
For individual okay and group okay.
Yeah.
So what's the IRF symbol for is the group okay?
And the IRF haven't got that far yet.
Okay.
It's not been implemented. Something I personally teach
is,
are you personally okay? If I'm talking to a guide, I'll give them the fingers on the top of the head, the international signal, because that's what guides know. And then if I'm asking the same guide, is everything okay in your boat? It's just a simple look at them and a thumbs up.
And why is, I mean, this is, everybody in the US thinks this is insane, right? Like, why is it pointing, like, fingers down, pointing your head instead of tapping your head?
Because depending on where you're working, the rest of the world, fingers down, tapping on top of your head is a signal for last boat.
Say that again. The fingers down.
So hand flat on the top of the head.
Uh-huh.
So your fingers are horizontal to your head.
Yep.
Yep. And then tapping your head or making a forward motion is the signal for last boat.
So we've just developed our own thing, and the rest of the world, like other parts of the world, developed their own signals, and the IRF is trying to bring them all under one house.
Yeah, which is like trying to herd kittens.
It's insane. There's no way we're going to change in the U.S.
And you know what? You don't have to change. Yeah. All you need to do is make sure your guides are all working off the same set of signals.
So when I asked the most commonly missed question on that quiz, was the IRF signal for you're okay? Because we all do something different. And almost everybody who's taken the quiz has never even heard of, probably very few have heard of the IRF, much less that they have their own signals, and then that is the answer.
Yeah. And, you know, it gets confusing for me because I teach Rescue 3 classes, and Rescue 3 have got to talk the different signals from the IRF. But something we always teach is that if we're going to go into any operational area, is before you do anything, make sure you're all working with the same set of signals.
Yeah.
So a quick discussion, what are we going to use for okay? What are we going to use for stop? You know.
Yep. Cool. Those are my questions. Priscilla, do you have any questions before you wrap this thing up?
Oh. No, I think I'm good.
Cool.
Good discussion.
Yeah. Mark, do you have anything to add before we go into our we always end the episode with the gear of the week. We talk about a piece of gear, but do you have anything you want to add or talk about?
No, I'm good.
Cool. Well, do you guys have any gear of the week? Something new.
Let me think.
Okay. Mark, do you have anything?
Yeah, from Europe, I've got two pieces.
Let's do it.
All right. So the first one, and I've already mentioned them twice, is the new harness on the Palm PFDs. We're lucky enough in Europe, we have two very experienced outdoor practitioners called Lowell Collins and Chris Onions, and they're like rope gods and teaching gods in the UK. And they actually wrote a paper on harness release, on that chest harness release, because unfortunately we've had a lot of chest harness release failures down to design, poor education, improper use. So they went out and they tested a whole heap of harnesses under releasing different types of release mechanisms. And as a result of that, they actually went away and they redesigned the release system on the chest harness. And the new Palm PFDs that are coming out now have got the piggyback harness and the UCLAN. UCLAN is the University of Central Lancashire in the UK. And they've brought out these two new systems for releasing the harness, which is really good. So that's one piece of equipment. So the harness is on the new Palm PFDs. And then, Zach, I saw your article, your video on boots, on water boots.
Uh-huh.
There's a Spanish company called Bestard, and they make Canyoneers for grown-ups. Some really good, well-manufactured boots.
They are hard. They're a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah, well, they're good boots.
Yeah, those are boots you give your kids. Yeah, I'll put a link to those on the website. They're pretty cool. I never heard of them. I think you wore those last year, right?
I had the search and rescue ones on last year, but this year I'm going to bring out the River Pro ones with me, the Wild Water River ones.
Sweet. Let's go back to chest harnesses really quick. What is it? You mentioned that there's been failures. Is a chest harness failure that it opens when it's not supposed to, or that it doesn't open?
Opens when it's not supposed to. The harness actually being located in a place where it can't actually be released. For instance, I think it's the Stoliquest PFDs, mm-hmm. that if you actually don't do the harness up properly and then you then put tension on the harness, the actual buckle will rotate inwards and you physically cannot release it.
Wow. Yeah, that's scary.
And then a lot of the failures have come from the length of the tail. Yeah. So if you actually look at the webbing on the harness, a lot of people don't cut down that webbing. Yeah. And then they've gone to use their harness and it's become snagged in the buckle because it's too long.
I always say a hand. You want a hand length. However wide your hand is, you want that much sticking out at the end. The more you cut it down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have no gear of the week. I haven't been boating for 2.5 months because I had surgery on my hand. So I have nothing exciting to talk about. Priscilla, do you have any in the gear of the week?
No, I don't either. I've been also lacking in the boating.
Well, hopefully that changes here really soon because I'm looking outside. Yes. The weather's amazing. Our rivers here, they're starting to flow. We have to start getting my surgery. I can paddle at the WindFest. That's my first day I can paddle. So I'm 11 days away from boating again. Well, cool. Mark, thanks for joining us. It's good to catch up on this stuff. I mean, I think
thanks for having me.
These are questions people have been asking me a ton through just like discussions I've had and things I wondered about. And I know last time I interviewed you, we never even met, and I knew nothing about the IRF, so it's good to dive a little deeper. And it's gonna be good. So thanks, guys.
Cool. Yeah, all right, thank you. Gonna flow me into a new state of mind. I'm on Chattahoochee on the Rio Grande, the Allegheny and the Cumberland, on this river. Oh, this river's running fine. Gonna float me down that